So what if we got people who are genetically the same?
Just like us.
I was scared to death, to tell you the truth, of what was going to happen, because we didn't know.
Twins share the same DNA, so we get to see if it's about your genes, not your genes.
And twins were biologically younger. They were no longer identical because they had, you know, their DNA was changing. And that was, you know, shocking to everyone. When you have the data, the signal that's so clear, like you want to live long, you want to have, you know, live without chronic disease, a vegan diet's the way to go.
Hi there. I've got some great guests coming up in the pipeline. So do please subscribe so you don't miss out. Now back to the show. Welcome to Plant CEO. In today's episode, I'd like to welcome back Louis Fasoyas, the film director of You Are What You Eat, A Twin Experiment. He's also done The Cove, Racing to Extinction, Mission Joy, The Game Changers, and he also looks after Oceanic Preservation Society. Hey, Louis, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Just to start with, I spoke with Jane Velez Mitchell, the editor of Unchained TV, and she called you a hero for getting this information out to the public. I would agree with her, and would you like a cape or no cape?
No, I mean, really, it's flattering, but it's really just about trying to use what talents we have to try to make the world a tiny little bit better place. And
yeah,
and there's a lot of people involved. I mean, like when you're doing a film, it's a collaborative effort. You have, you know, we had Netflix, we had producers, we had great editors. It's like a whole team of people. And I just feel like I'm the full goose loony at the top of it. So it's nice when it works. I tell you, that film has had so much, or that series has had so much response from the public and the medical community. I wasn't counting on it. To give you an idea of how much engagement that project has, it's based on an experiment that, for people that know that, I was just curious of, you know, after we did a film called The Game Changers, people said, oh, well, you know, I got off the diet because I'm Northern European, I need milk, or I'm, you know, Asian and I need fish, you know, and I was curious, is like, well, is there really anything about genetics that predisposes somebody to needing, you know, a different kind of nutrition? And I thought, well, why not use twins, identical twins, as kind of guinea pigs for a project? And what we did is we took 21 sets of twins, actually 22, one pair dropped out. So 21 sets of twins, and for 8 weeks, we gave one of them a whole foods, plant-based diet, and the other twin a healthy, you know, a healthy omnivore diet. By healthy, I mean, it wasn't like we were giving them Oreos and Coca-Cola for the vegans and, you know,
yeah,
garbage food for the omnivores as well. So they're both healthy by, you know, let's say the standards of the medical community. We're giving all the nutrients and we weren't giving them junk food. And and it was published, the results were published by the Journal of American Medicine, which is one of the most respected medical journals in the entire world. And there's a service called Altmetrics, which measures the engagement by the scientific community and the public, the general public. And a score of 20 is high, 20. I think ours is now over 1800, 1800. So almost like two orders of magnitude more popular than the most popular study that's ever been done in science. So this thing is like, it's gone through the roof. It's captured the world's imagination in a way that I, you know, hadn't attended. I thought, well, I'll just walk away from that project and start doing something new because, you know, who knows if it's going to do anything. And it struck a nerve, you know, probably because nobody had ever really done it to this extent with twins before and, you know, kind of rigorous. And it's only, you know, 21 sets of twins, so 42 people. And people say, well, it's not that big enough for a real test. But the thing is, I mean, I have trouble trying to find the right metaphor. But when you get a really strong signal from a study, you don't need a lot of people. So if you're doing a vaccine and there's 10 children that are dying of a disease and all 10 get better, and you're have the 11th child, you don't go up, we need more testing, you know. It's,
yeah.
And the results were so stunning, and And for some of the, you know, like for the telomeres and epigenetic tests and
right.
And TMAO, which is, you know, only found in meat, and it's, you know, inflammatory molecule that, you know, is associated with all these, you know, the most chronic diseases we have, heart disease, diabetes, and cancers. It's like, it was shocking to everyone.
Yeah, I learned about the telomeres on your show, so I didn't actually know about that. And yeah, I thought it was fascinating how, you know, it was decreasing on a plant-based diet, and your metabolic age decreases, which is surprising in that period of time, right?
Yeah. So Elizabeth Blackburn, she won the Nobel Prize for her work on telomerase. And for the people who don't know, telomerase is the enzyme. It's the telomeres are the end caps of your DNA that basically create the coding for the next cell. Your body, your cells are always regenerating. And the coding that basically it's like a, you can call it like a CD, you know, like if it gets scratched or starts to get broken, it can't transfer the data accurately to the next cell. And as you get older, you know, you start to lose your hair or you start to
yeah. Well, at least you have hair.
Yeah, a little bit. And so shorter telomeres, shorter life, longer telomeres, longer life. And you could actually regrow these telomeres. They get longer. We know this over a long time. If you have the right lifestyle, they can. That's why people like in the blue zones, the places where people live the longest without chronic disease,
right,
they want longer telomeres. And so you want longer telomeres. And what shocked everybody was that the telomeres got longer with the plant-based twins. When we did the study, you know, I had to raise the money for the study. And the scientists over at Stanford University who conducted the study said, well, save your money on the telomeres and epigenetics. You won't see any kind of changes in 8 weeks. And I was, because I knew Dan Buettner, who popularized the Blue Zones, because we both worked right. at National Geographic. I was a photographer. He was a writer.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And I was curious, like, would it have anything to do with telomeres? And they said, save your money. And that was probably the most astounding part of the whole study was all
totally.
The... And twins were biologically younger. They were no longer identical because they had, you know, their DNA was changing. And that was, you know, shocking to everyone.
The other thing I found really interesting was the visceral fat reduction as well in the plant-based eaters.
Yeah, we weren't even really looking for that. And you know, we know people lose weight on a vegan diet. I want to be clear with everybody too. It's like there's a lot of unhealthy vegan food out there, just, you know, snack foods and all
100%.
That.
100%. Yeah.
Just because it says plant-based or vegan doesn't mean it's healthy. But again, everybody was on a healthy omnivore diet and a healthy whole food plant-based diet. And the visceral fat is the fat around your organs, which again is diagnostic for these metabolic diseases like heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. And if you have 4 pounds more, 4 pounds or more of visceral fat, this fat that is really hard to get rid of around your organs, it means you're ripe for these metabolic diseases. And that seemed to evaporate on the vegans. You know, even the ones that weren't as, let's say, compliant or, you know, exercised as much as the omnivore twins, it was melting off. There's two twins that are a pair of twins that that were really rigorous. You know, probably more. They live together. They exercise together. Well, I went to the gym with them, and they're doing like the amount of weight, the same amount of rep. John and Javon, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They were great.
Yeah. And the vegan twin, he didn't have much visceral fat to begin with. It was like, I want to say 0.3 pounds. And by the end of the study, it had almost disappeared. I mean, it was just a trace amount.
Yeah. Amazing. He was the one with the deeper voice, and he liked all the steak and the chicken before, right?
Yeah. I think all the twins have changed their diet, you know, not 100%, but I think the results were so stunning for them. It becomes very clear, right? Like when you have the data, the signal that's so clear, like you want to live long, you want to have, you know, live without chronic disease, a vegan diet's the way to go. Now, you know, that said, you know, people say, well, you know, you're cherry picking the data. No, I was scared to death to tell you the truth of what was going to happen because we didn't know. We knew that on a vegan diet, we're going to get some positive results in a short time. We knew that you could lose weight, you could improve your blood pressure, and you could improve your cholesterol. So we knew we'd have those going for us. But all the others, we had no idea. Nobody
had
idea.
Yeah.
You know, so it was pleasantly shocking in a positive way that the results were so good. But, you know, these weren't a cherry pick. And people say, oh, well, you know, you have a vegan, you know, filming it, and, you know, the researcher.
The bias side.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like, well, of course we want the data to support our belief, but everything was blinded. We didn't know. We didn't know until, you know, they pull the curtain away from the data, what it was. And I'm telling you, everybody was shocked across the board about a lot of this data. You know, we had no idea what was going to go on with the microbiome or the telomeres or TMAO. TMAO was only found in animal products. So we knew that was going to go down. But still, I mean,
yeah.
You know, again, it's, you know, a molecule that's associated with all these metabolic diseases. You don't want a lot of TMAO in your system or any of it, but you're going to get loads of it. So here's the thing, an omnivore diet, you know, animal products are more nutrient dense, so you don't have to eat as much.
Correct.
On a plant-based diet, you have to eat more. And right. people weren't used to that, you know, like there's, it's counterintuitive, like I eat more and I'm going to get thinner.
Yeah. It's opposite because of the water content as well in the veg, whereas the meat is really dense. And obviously we both know Nimai Delgado, who's your fitness coach. And I went on his training program, and the consumption that you need to eat for the food is very high. People need to get used to that. And if you don't eat as much, you won't put on as much muscle mass, which is basically what happened in the show. So there were some learnings for those people. Like you, if you're working out, you need to eat more.
Yeah. Did you do Nimai's?
I did. Yeah. I did. Oh, well, yeah.
I did too. And I only did it after the study was over. And I was like, you know, I've got to admit, like when I was filming the twins, I was like, oh, why is this so hard for you? When I did it, I was like, oh, now I get it. This is really difficult to measure your food, to eat properly, to keep track of your calories, to do all the exercises that were to revere, you know, my days really packed, and you know, to have everybody's day, like we all just have the same amount of time, we're all really busy, but when you add, it's almost like another job when you have to do, you know, an hour of workouts, and we were pretty strenuous for the first month, you know, weighing food and keeping track of it and putting it all into these apps. It was like, oh, this is a lot of work.
Yeah, I experienced this exactly the same thing as well. It was tough. And plus the workouts were like, you can see why he's so built as well, right? He's doing that all the time. I remember last time we spoke about him jumping the 2 meters like a gazelle. He did that. You added that clip in. I saw this time, because I don't know if you filmed that before or if that was a recent thing that you still can do now.
It was a while ago that we did it. You know, like 2 or 3 years ago, but you know, it took 4 years to film that. It was
The whole show.
He's gone through a lot of changes.
He has
some tattoos and stuff like that. So people are like, "Was this? Is this? You know, is this for real?" You know, but it's like, you know, you do a documentary over 4 years, and people, they change their haircut. They, you know, they grow mustaches and beards. They shave them off. They get, you know, they get older.
It's
and you're not editing these in a perfect time sequence. So that parts of that were done probably 4 years ago. And you know, the thing about bodybuilders too, they go through these phases, right? They, like when you're bulking up for a performance, you know, you get a little bit of fat on you. You're eating more, and then you start cutting. You know, so you're.
Right.
You're doing you're basically, you build up the muscle and the fat, then you cut off the fat. And so I think when we were filming Nimai, it was, was a professional bodybuilder. He was like, okay, well, don't film me yet. I'll have to do it in a few months when I'm going to cut. So I look better. So
for sure.
The guy looks like Captain America.
He does. But,
but he'll, you know, he's, you know, when you're, when he's looking at it with a little bit different eye than, let's say, the average viewer. He's looking at his body through a bodybuilder's eyes.
Yeah, for sure. I actually had a vegan stuntman, Hollywood stuntman, appear as a guest on the show. And he had been vegan for 10 years, actually. He went through a process of trying different diets, you know, on a meat diet. He found that he had a lot of inflammation. And then he went on to a pescatarian diet and found that he had a lot of mercury in his blood. It took him a year to get rid of that out of his system. And then he went on to a dairy diet. And he found that he had a lot of stomach issues. And then this is 10 years ago, so he's settled now on vegan, and he's been 10 years vegan. He was a double for Tarzan. I'm going to introduce you to him. I think he'll be good for you to know him, maybe for your next film. But I think you can be super strong. He does all this like calisthenics stuff. Whether he's bulking or wants to be a bit more flexible, it depends on the role basically, and they have to turn around in this period of time. So yeah, it's quite a science, but if you get it right, you get it right.
Yeah, I mean, the people I talk to at the universities that do these nutrition studies, even if they're omnivore, they say the vegan diet is the way to go. When you look at all the data, when you look at all the meta-analysis of all the studies, and you start looking at like what's the best for the human body, with the criteria of feeling better, more energy, reducing inflammation, living longer without chronic disease, a vegan diet wins hands down every time. So then the question you have to ask yourself is then why isn't everybody vegan or plant-based or whatever you want to call it? Why is, and I think we're trending that way. I think we're trending that we're accelerating that way. Like in the UK, certainly, I think
100%, yeah.
I think the younger people, the generation
Right.
15, 25 or 30, I remember it was like in the high 20s of the percentile now identify as like flexitarians or,
Yeah,
let's
I
say.
mean, in the UK, there's 2.5 million people that identify as vegans now,
Wow.
and you've got a fifth of the people are in London actually, with a huge amount more people who are wanting to reduce their meat intake as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's growing here. It's huge here, and everyone's interested in this topic. And I think there's also cool things that we don't know as much. I know you touched on some of this on your series was about the microbiome, and by having a variety of fruit and veg, that actually feeds it. And I was quite interested to see that.
Yeah, if you don't eat your veggies, yeah, if you don't basically line your gut with veggies,
That was
your gut
right. Yeah.
are eating you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the Sonnenbergs. It's a husband and wife team that are both university professors at Stanford. They studied the microbiome. And, again, they're both plant-based. And that's because if you know the data and you're a scientist and you act on the science, you eat what the data tells you. And then the question becomes, why doesn't the general public, right? Because, obviously this we're heading that direction, but why do people watch the program
Yeah.
and understand the data, or they maybe reject it for whatever reasons, or maybe they accept it and they still persist on eating these animal products, yet they know it. But I think the answer is it takes a while. A lot of people are doing it. It's difficult when you have a whole culture that moves that direction, right? When you go out to eat with friends and they're omnivores and they're the odd man out that's like struggling to try to work the waiter to try to get something to eat that's healthy. So we're all sick of that. Like you go to a restaurant and all they have, oh, we have a salad. Well, come on, we're all smart enough now to know that salad is good for some things, but it's not going to sustain you. That's what people think. You get the or it's pasta and vegetables. It's like we want healthy food, we want nourishing food, we want food that tastes good, and we're getting there, but it's going to take a while. One reason we had Daniel Hume, who's the he was voted, for people don't know, there's he was voted best chef in the world, I think in 2017, best restaurant in the world. And he's a three-star Michelin chef. He lived in Madison Park in New York City. And during the pandemic, that's a great story. He basically, this is back in the early parts of the pandemic when they thought just being around contact with somebody, could kill you. Now everybody was going out of business. His restaurant went from being, 3 month waiting list to being going dark. And he realized that all these people that were manufacturing food that were delivering to them, their food was going rotten because they didn't have access to, the grocery stores and all that. So there's no place to do it. So I thought, let's make the food in our kitchen and we'll give it away. And so he brought back a skeleton crew. They all wear masks. The restaurant part, the dining room's dark, the kitchen goes light, And they made, I think, 1 million meals and gave them away during the pandemic. And he started to realize that people were undernourished. They didn't have the food they needed. And he started thinking about, like, why am I still serving meat? Like, when we know it's healthier, know it's better for us. And he wanted to use his restaurant as a beacon for the rest of the community. And he thought, I could lose all my stars, but this is the way to go. This is the way we all need to be doing. And I have a chance to use my platform to elevate the level of the Michelin. You know, everybody can afford a Michelin meal.
Right.
They're expensive. They're it's kind of seen as elitist, but Daniel has such a great heart. So he made this leap, and the restaurant maintained his 3 stars, even after they went vegan. And here's the thing, they still give away 5 free meals for every meal that you eat there to people that can't afford it.
That's brilliant. And,
yeah, no, it's a wonderful story. He's a wonderful guy, and you know, it's changing on a community level, restaurant level. But to me, it was like a beacon. You know, I wanted to use him in the story to say that, you know, because people say, well, the vegan, you know, meals aren't that tasty. Well, anybody that's eaten at a 1-star Michelin chef, you know, restaurant knows that this is one of the best meals you've ever had in your life. And 3 stars, it's like, oof. So right away dispels the notion that you can't have a tasty vegan food, because one of the best restaurants in the world, certainly the best, the only 3-star vegan restaurant in the world, maintains 3 stars with the plant-based restaurant.
Totally, yeah. And also, obviously, in New York, and you had Mayor Eric Adams that gave his own story. And I think the work that he's doing at hospitals is brilliant, like in the state hospitals now offering plant-based options as a default. Whereas before, if somebody was to choose it themselves and it was labeled, say, vegan, only 1% was doing it. And you can imagine now, to those people learning about this and their health outcomes, you know, it's kind of like if they didn't have this and you got lung disease and you come in with a plate of cigarettes to give them, right? It's same sort of thing.
Yeah, to set this up a little bit more, you know, obviously, like I said, Eric Adams is the mayor of New York. He woke up one morning and he couldn't see. He was going blind. He went to his doctor. The doctor said, well, you know, you have diabetes, you know, early stage diabetes. And if you don't take these meds, you're, you know, it's just going to get worse. You're going to probably get your, you know, some extremities amputated. You know, that's just the nature of the disease. And he gave him all these drugs, you know, for his diabetes, and a pamphlet that said, living with diabetes. And leaving the doctor's office, he said, you know, this is not my destiny. And he just Googled reversing diabetes, and it found all these doctors that we're all familiar with. And he tried it for 3 months, and he came back and his tests were all positive. And his endocrinologist, I think it was, said, well, the drugs must be working. He said, no, you know, I didn't do the drugs. I did a whole food plant-based diet. It wasn't my DNA. It was my dinner. And so what he did was pretty radical. You know, he said, well, you go to the hospital and you see people eating all this food that got them there in the first place. So like you said, now the default at all, it's the biggest metropolitan municipal hospital system in the world, I believe, the New York system. And, you know, now you go there and you have it defaults to vegan. And then in the schools, he also has a meatless Monday and a plant forward Friday. So 2 days a week, the kids are, you know, given these plant-based options. So they're, you know, it's starting to change on a level. The question I always ask is like, you know, where are we on this curve, right?
Yeah.
Is it a curve that's trending upward? And if so, where are we on that curve? And I think we're at the point that we're starting to curve up in pretty dramatically. Let me give you just a little. I can't remember if we talked about this the last time, but I had one of the first 3 electric cars in Colorado, the state of Colorado.
We spoke about it. I did a whole bit on that. Actually, it was great.
Yeah. And well, just, you know, people haven't seen that I was powering it with 114 solar panels on my roof. And I was like, look what we're doing. You know, in the cars back then, it only had 120 miles of range, but like, I didn't pay for gas. When people were paying $5 or $6 a gallon, I don't know if the equivalent is like $9, $10 to get a gallon for gasoline, and I'm not paying anything. And the electric company's paying me for production. And, you know, I just thought, well, why aren't more people driving electric cars? And now there's, you know, I remember when you could see it, you saw a Tesla on the road and it's like, oh, look, there's a electric car, you know, hi, and you'd wave to them. And now
they're everywhere.
I'm in California. It feels like, you know, every fourth or fifth car is a Tesla,
right,
or an electric vehicle. So we're you know, electric yeah. vehicles are a trend. We're probably like, I'd say circa 2010, 2011 in terms right. of the plant-based movement. You know,
yeah.
what's going to be, I hope soon, like eating animal products on a plane will be like smoking on a plane.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do it, or
same thing. Yeah.
There'll be a room for you to do it at the airport. You go outside, you know,
yeah.
back in the alley.
Yeah. I think, you know, we spoke about there before about, like, you know, why aren't people adopting it to it faster? And I always think that it's, you know, we said that it's kind of cultural, and, you know, when you're sitting down at a meal, at a restaurant, etc. And one of the things is stuff like this definitely is a bit of a wake up call, but also we have to realize that people are on their own journeys. And as an industry, we can't be too judgy about that. I went on my own journey. You went on your own journey, I'm sure. And the science just has to tell the truth. And I think that's what we're finding out now. And you know, I think what we've got to be mindful of is that, you know, in the Western world, for example, where people can have 3 meals a day, times by 7 is 21 meals. And if we look at that and say, well, okay, great. How many of those meals are plant-based? If it's one, great. Have one more, you know, and start increasing that number. And it's a good thing to do. What's your advice for activists now working in this industry to sort of wake up, you know, whether it's sort of animal welfare or planetary health? What's your thoughts on the direction they should be taking?
Well, I mean, everybody's going to take their own, like you say, their own journey. What we found is that, well, let's say the funders of our project, you know, there's a group of high net worth individuals that, you know, emotionally are attached to this for a lot of variety of reasons. It's usually animal welfare, the environment, and a lesser extent health. But you have to, you know, I'm always looking for the lever. What's the lever that's going to get people to change? And you might, you know, listen, I spent more time than I'd ever want to at a CAFO, these concentrated animal feeding operations, which is where 99%. Over 99% of the food in America comes from. If people haven't seen one, and there's no reason you should unless you work at one, because they won't let you visit one. Nobody's going to let you see how the chickens are raised, or your turkey, or the ducks, or the pigs, or, you know, just look, see how what's going on at a feedlot. Because if you saw it, or where your cows are being milked, because if people knew the process, that where almost all their animal products come from, it would be repelling. And so if you do visit a CAFO, you know, 15 seconds, 10 seconds in any shed of, you know, filled with chickens, we're talking 10, 20, 30, 40,000 chickens, the ammonia hits you. And you realize this isn't like some anomaly. This is where these animals have to live in 24/7. This is their life. There's in this ammonia-filled shed. It has big fans. It's just, so when you have, you know, 40,000 chickens all defecating and urinating in the same spot, is going to be a lot of buildup of ammonia. 10 seconds in that would it be enough to repel you from having anything to do with a chicken in your entire life? And I think the industry knows that. So you have these what they call ag gag laws here, where they don't allow people to see what some journalists to go in to see what's going on. You can get arrested.
Yeah, they're not having windows.
Yeah, exactly. They don't want people walking up and seeing where their food comes from. But there's a reason for that, because if you did, it would destroy your market. It's very bad marketing to see that billions of animals around the world are being tortured. If you treated, you know, the animals that, you know, we keep, you know, dogs and cats that way, or horses, you would be jailed. But we do this to these other species, and pigs are really intelligent too, you know. But here's the thing. It's like you go there and you feel emotionally like people need to see this. Mm-hmm. People aren't ready to hear that information because they believe it's normal, natural, and necessary to eat that way. You have to first get to them in a different way, you know, because the information is too counterintuitive. It's like, we need to eat this way. You know, we have to eat this way. We're built to, this is the narrative that people tell themselves. We're hunter-gatherers. Well, we're not hunter-gatherers. I know the people that came up with the name the hunter-gatherers, it was a conference that was done, and I think in the 1960s, and it was originally called the Gatherer-Hunter Conference. But their professor said, well, it's not going to be, you know, sexy enough. Call it the hunter-gatherers, because, you know, men were deciding the names, and, you know, hunting is it's really a social construct. You know, when they go into these primitive cultures where they're still, you know, pretty much unaffected by Western, you know, ideas, there's hunting and gathering going on, but most of the calories are collected by the women who are gathering, because the men mostly come back empty-handed. And hunting is a social construct. Like I got the animal, so therefore I get the female, and, you know, there's a pecking order that's created on social grounds, not on caloric grounds. So, I mean, if you looked at it, this the cold hard facts. In these cultures, women are the primary, you know, gatherers of the most protein.
Yeah,
it puts this idea in its head, because it's, you know, there's still a patriarchy going on. You know, we like to think we're manly, to be eating meat, and then nothing could be further from the truth. They go out and they get meat, and sometimes the amount of calories that they expend on a hunt exceeds what it costs to go get there. But it's a social construct. And by the way, I mean, here's the thing: 4% of the mass of mammals on the planet are wild. It would take, like, if we said, okay, we're not going to raise animals anymore, we're going to go out and hunt for our animals to get our protein, you would expend the total population of wild animals, all the giraffes, elephants, you know, all the mammals, in about 4 months. That's about all the fuel that there is to feed humanity.
Yeah, it's insane, isn't it?
Yeah, and so we're not hunter-gatherers anymore. We're basically torturing these animals so we could eat them. And now the question, how do you get around this narrative, right? Because people don't want to hear that, especially somebody that's not there, like they're not ready to hear the information. So the lever for me is like what we did with the Game Changers. You know, you have the anti-hero, James Wilkes, the protagonist, like, who is a meat eater and a UFC fighter, a killer. You know, he was training the UFC champion who, you know, was teaching the Federales and the Navy SEALs how to kill people with their bare hands. And he gets injured and, you know, discovers that the best way to recovery was a plant-based diet. It was counterintuitive to everything he was thinking about. So then he becomes the avatar. You let his discovery be like, you know, a proxy for the average person. It actually, you know, that the average jock who might think, oh, you have to eat meat to be big and strong. So there's a lever. There's always a lever. And in this case, I think with the twin experiment, it was the twins. It's like there's a very diverse group of twins becoming the proxy for the reader and saying, you know, along the way, you'll learn what we learned. It's healthy. Live longer.
So I was thinking also, like, when you thought about the twin idea, did you also think about triplets and giving one of the triplets like a meat and dairy, the other one pescatarian, and then the last one vegan? I mean, you could go on, right? Just have all the, you can have one with a Mediterranean diet. You
know? Actually, I did not think of it, and you know what? Go for it. You know, it's a lot of work to come up with the ideas for this stuff. I mean, we can sit here and think of like, oh, let's do this, but then come up with the money for it, come up with the researchers, and there's a whole
must be a big project. And how did you find those twins, by the way? Was that from the Stanford University? They kind of conducted that and found them. And
There's all kinds of twin registries where twins have opened themselves up for study by medical communities around the world. There's actually a great one in London. I'm a space on his last name, but he's been doing an ongoing twin study for quite a while.
Related to diet?
the diet is part of it, but it's I think they're looking at everything, you know.
Right.
When, you know, twins are such a great analog for studies, because you have the, you know, one twin do, you know, you can start to parse out, like, well, here's the thing, like, if you ask somebody what they ate, if you ask me what I ate, you know, it's like, I'm not going to remember everything. I'm going to probably exaggerate the good stuff and, you know, minimize the bad stuff. Now, I'll give you an idea. I did a story once. It's actually, I've got it here holding up my computer. It's
okay.
I did a story for, yeah, you can't see that.
Oh, it's defocusing, yeah. Oh, yeah, now it's it. Yeah, there you go.
For National Geographic on trash. It was in 1983.
Oh, wow.
Now, there's a guy in that article, William Rathjay. He's a garbologist, and I'll get it. This will make sense here in a second. He was an archaeologist, worked on Mayan cultures, but he said the best thing you could do is find out what an ancient culture was actually doing is to find the garbage pit. That's where they had the bones of the refuse. And obviously all the plants would erode quicker. What would be left would be the bones. They didn't find a lot of bones, but he said, well, why don't we apply the same methodologies that we do analyzing ancient cultures to modern culture. So he would, you know, he's working in Tucson, Arizona in the US, and he would, at the front door would be some college PhDs with a clipboard asking people what the family ate in the front door, right? They get somebody at the front door. At the back door, somebody's stealing their garbage.
Yeah.
Literally, they're taking the garbage, right? So like,
yeah.
So they'll ask, like, how much do you drink? Oh, we don't drink much at all. Maybe a couple beers a week, blah, blah, blah. Not much meat, you know. We're big on the veggies, you know, in the blah. And then they're going through the garbage and looking at all the wrappers, and they're forensically adding up what they actually ate to what, and comparing it to what they said they ate. And there's a big discrepancy, right? So
it's amazing.
So when you ask somebody how many eggs they ate a week or how much they drink a week, highly suspect. These tests where you're relying on people to self-report what they say they do is like, it's not trustworthy. We were controlling, as you know, and listen, you know, we delivered food for the first 4 weeks to the twins. And we were pretty sure they're eating what they said they ate. But, you know, we'd go to, sometimes you go to the halfway mark and you go check on the refrigerators. Just, you know, you might have to take a look in there. And you see that there's some stuff that, you know, probably shouldn't be in there if you're
right. Big.
So we think that people were pretty adherent because you can see that the TMAO is going down. TMAO is only found in animal products. So when, you know, so we know that they were adherent. You know, because there's these markers, these biological markers that you can tell, but still you don't know, right? And I just think that we are our own worst enemies when it comes to giving the truth to what we're actually consuming. And when you do Nimai's project, when you actually start to tally when I start to tally what I was putting in my mouth, it wasn't horrible. It's just like, you know, I'd be like, oh, I'm eating nuts. That'll be healthy. It can't be that many calories. And it's like a quarter cup of nuts is like 250 calories. And I, you know, it wasn't more. Is he doing more than a quarter cup? When you do the addition, it's like, oh my God, no wonder I'm, you know.
Yeah.
Not as small as I wish I was. So when you're doing this, when somebody doesn't know that if you're part of a study, you know, you're going to try to be a little bit more adherent because in this case, you know, the eyes of the world are looking at you. But, you know, when you're just going up to random houses and asking people what they ate, I don't believe it. I don't think, you know how hard it is to keep track. If you have a app there and every time you're consuming, oh, that was an 8-ounce glass of whatever, juice, kombucha or whatever, you start to add it up. It's horrifying
totally.
Horrifying to me, like how much I was actually consuming and not paying attention to it. Now I pay attention to it because of Nimai's.
Yeah. And that's why it's such a good name for the show. You are what you eat. And also my dad would say your stomach isn't a graveyard for dead animals. and thinking about that, I actually went on a podcast of a friend of mine, and it's called Leadership in Color by Shez Ekbel, and he's actually got twins, so he was really interested to learn more. So I came on his show and I started talking about it with him. It's fascinating, like people have seen it and they're talking about it. And I think your choice of those twins were also great. Their personalities were brilliant. It was so nice to see how they're finishing off each other's sentences. And like one I remember was when Charlie and Michael, who love their cheeses, right? Michael was like, you know, sometimes I might want to go outside and walk alone. So he goes, come on, come on, Charlie, let's go. It was like, oh, that was brilliant. So the little snippets that you added was just like really quite nice in between.
Yeah, there's something about twins. There's the camaraderie, the companionship, the competitiveness, and some, you know, twins is so, it's adorable, right? I mean, it's infectious to watch them. And I wasn't counting on that so much. I mean, I thought that would be like, I didn't want it to be a distraction to the program, but it became kind of like a nice through line.
And it was kind of, you want to see those little interactions as part of the story. So I think it worked really well. Are you thinking of keeping a track on the ones that were in the study? And are you going to be following, like, especially the ones who, because I guess they're also now starting their own journey. Like maybe some of them didn't go completely plant-based, but are you thinking of following up with them and perhaps do another story about them?
All these great ideas you have, I hope you're coming up with funding for me, right?
Yeah, sure. No problem.
Excellent idea. You know, I think more importantly, I would be curious to the reader about the readers, the impact of the readers. What I've always wanted to do is get, you know, the funding for a study to say you do a film like the twin experiment, and you interview, I don't know, whatever the base amount of people you need to do a population grade study. I think it's like 1,100 people. So you have 1,100 people test before they see the program, then you have them see the program, and then you ask them questions about what they eat and if they'll change it, and then you do a follow-up a year later and 5 years later to find out what's the impact of the series on the general population. Because what I want to know is how effective a project is, and you can start to calculate how much CO2 you save, how much fresh water is saved, how many animals are, you know, not leading a life of suffering. You could probably do a calculation then based on how well people's health, the general public's health, is doing. You know, the insurance companies, if this film is having, or the series is having, a serious effect on people adopting a plant-based diet, insurance rates should go down because people will be healthier.
Yeah.
You know, Dan Buettner, again, is the guy that popularized the idea of the Blue Zones. He has a project, it's called the Blue Zones Project, where he goes into cities around mostly America and tries to turn them into a blue zone city. You know, again, for the people who don't know, like, blue zones are places where people live the longest without chronic disease. They live, you know, back in the 2000s when he was doing that study for Geographic, there was a lot of centenarians, you know, people living over 100, like these large concentrations of, that shouldn't be there. There shouldn't be like a small community of people with, you know, 30, 100-year-old of a town of just a few thousand. Like, what are these people doing differently? Mm-hmm. And what he found was that about 95% of their calories were coming from a whole foods, plant-based diet. There's other things going on in these communities. There is a sense of community that they are exercising. They're doing their own gardens. They're growing their own veggies. There's a lot of other things that you can do to live longer, but the most important thing is by putting the right fuel in the tank. And these people were doing it, not by design, but it was almost because of default. It was easier and cheaper to grow your own vegetables. They were living on hillsides, so they were walking a lot. They were getting exercise, not like, you know, they weren't going to the gyms. They were, you know.
For sure. And in Okinawa, they don't have the sofas and they're sitting on the floor, so they're getting up and down. Or in Sardinia, they're walking up the hills. And
right. What Dan would found about trying to go into these communities like Fort Worth, Texas, and he would, you know, work with the community, the mayor and the chambers of commerce to get bike paths, get people, you know, doing more natural exercising and getting the at least two plant-based meals on a restaurant, so you get the little blue zone plaque. What he found is that the insurance company, there'd be like usually one insurance company that was paying for him just to do a study, you know, like a longitudinal study of like what's if you increase the health of a whole community, what's it going to save that company, that insurance company? What he found is that, like, you know, they would pay for, you know, I don't know, $250,000 or $1 million for Dan to go, you know, improve the health in this community. It's like the insurance rates for everybody went down, you know,
wow, because amazing.
Everybody got healthier. The BMI, you know, the body mass index for high school kids when they took out the vending machines or made it, you know, an infringement to eat snack. They take the vending machines out of all the high fructose, you know, drinks.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And everybody got healthier. It not only benefited that, not only paid for that insurance company, it paid for the whole community. And
yeah,
he just sold the Blue Zones project for $1 billion, you know, to Adventa. Yes, Adventa. It's the one of the big insurance companies in America.
Oh, I didn't know. Wow, amazing.
Yeah. If you can make these little changes across a population, it has an enormous effect on the health. And the cost of, you know, people say, well, like, don't tell me what to eat. Well, I'm not going to tell you what to eat. But you know what? When you eat unhealthy, it affects everybody. It's almost like, you know, eating animal products is like the secondhand smoke for the world, right? You know, like, it's like, okay, it might be your right to eat meat, but it's affecting our fresh water, it's affecting our air, and it's affecting our health premiums.
And also it's affecting the healthcare system, right? It's crippling the healthcare system. Like here, you know, our NHS waiting times, you go in to get to be seen. It's a fantastic system, but it's also full. And if we started to make this change into our diets, it will save so much money. And for them to do a lot more things with that money in terms of other types of research and outreach and changing people, but it just doesn't get spoken about with doctors, even at school. So I think the education is key to this as well.
Yeah, well, an anecdote here. My nephew just graduated from medical school and he's doing his residency now. And I thought, oh, he's vegan and he's exercises. He's like an Adonis. He's not quite Nemai's character, you know, yeah. But he's not a bodybuilder, but he's like, he's cut. He looks good. He's handsome. He's smart. And I thought, oh, we finally got a, you know, at least one, you know, vegan doctor in there. They don't. And he said to me, Uncle Lou, it's like, you don't have time. When you have somebody that's unhealthy, you come in, you have 12 minutes with them. You're not going to convince them in 12 minutes to change their diet. You can, you know, maybe advise them to, you know, eat more plants and, you know, and fruit. But he said that the system is set up so that all their time is just spent doing data and writing scripts. He says, you don't have time to try to change their behavior. And he said, when he does, you know, the doctors above him tell him to stay in his lane. You know, his job is to, you know, to recommend, you know, what drugs to give them. Because if they have high cholesterol, you give them a drug because, you know, if they don't do it, they're going to, you know, they could be set up for failing because, you know, there's more that needs to happen because they don't teach nutrition in medical schools. One doctor told me that the only nutritional advice he got in all of medical school was what to put in an IV bag. So the doctors are some of the least programmed of, you know, people to tell us, you know, how to improve our health. You know, they're good at drugs. Don't get me wrong. I mean, if I have something wrong, I want to have a doctor tell me, but I'm not convinced that they're the best ones to give nutritional advice.
Yeah, for sure.
They don't teach it.
They don't. And I think definitely missing a trick. And I don't know if it's because of the pharmaceutical industry wanting to obviously sell their drugs. And it's more of a commercial thing that it's not being taught or funding to universities or I don't know.
I think that's true. There's no money in it. Well, if the stats are right, somewhere between 75 and 80% of the chronic diseases we have are preventable and reversible by deciding to change your lifestyle, to eat better, eat more fruits and veggies and exercise. That's
For sure.
what most people need. Where's the money in that? You know, like, I don't think it's, I think it's just the way the system's set up. I was told in some cultures you pay the doctor when you're healthy and you don't pay him when when you're unhealthy. You know, that changes the whole ecosystem.
That's interesting. Do you know which culture that is?
You have to Google it. You know, I hope it's not one of those urban legend things.
So one thing I wanted to ask was, how are you able to get this crucial information with Netflix when other filmmakers seem to encounter some brick walls when it comes to these major streaming platforms? And do you have any advice on that?
Yeah, I mean, my advice is, like, you know, everything that we do is mission driven. You know, like, I'm looking, my goal is, when I look at doing any project that we take on, I think, like, how, if I work on this, and this can be a big time suck out of my life, my North Star is, how do you make the world a little bit better? How do you
Yeah,
change?
100%.
And it's not, you know, getting people to eat less animals because just because of suffering. I realize that people aren't going to sit down and watch a Netflix program because they want to be told that what they're eating is causing tons of suffering. First rule of filmmaking is, don't be boring. Make it interesting. And you know, and so that's what we try to do. It's like, you know, we're storytellers. I'm interested in, how do you use film to change culture? And that's our North Star. And it's not always like, the way you get there is not always a direct route. You know, sometimes it's counterintuitive. If you want to save animals, maybe the best way is to, you know, tell people a different story. You know, my advice is, like, figure out what you want to do with your life and figure out the best way to be effective. There's a difference between, most filmmakers want to make a film that makes them feel right. You know, like, I'm gonna tell people what to think or what to believe. And it's like, well, I want to tell people a good story so they can come up with their own conclusions. And I make want a film that's going to be effective more than make me feel like I'm right. You know what I mean? And we did throw caution to the wind on this wind experiment, because we, like I said, we didn't really know what was going to go on with a lot of the data. Thankfully, it came out, you know, the net positive for the vegans, because I was scared. You know, up until we got those results, I was like, oh man, you know. But I was willing to hear the uncomfortable truth, if that's what it was. It's like, well, then we'll know. Maybe you should be eating eggs. Maybe you should be eating some meat. Maybe you should be eating some fish. But all the data says, if you want to live long, if you want to live without chronic disease, eat a whole foods, plant-based diet. The data is really clear. You know, it's delivered through this very entertaining mechanism, the twins. It takes some thought. It takes some energy to think, like, how are you going to make an in how do you you know, you come back from a day of work. You're working, I don't know what you do in the UK, 8 hours here at least. Maybe you're commuting, but you know, you've got kids, you've got, you know, maybe your relationship's not great at home, you've got expenses. You don't want to hear a lot more bad news when you turn on the telly. You want to, like, be entertained.
Yeah, that's good advice. And so, do you have a next project in mind?
We've got five of them right now that we're working on.
Five? Wow. So, you know, the one we spoke last time, Food 2.0. Was that this project? Was this the this was that project? Okay, right. So,
That was the working title. Now this is
right,
where I
okay,
work.
fine. Fine. And so what can you tell me, if you can, about your next five?
I think the next one, you know, that's really exciting, is, I'm a little bit leery, only to because I know that there's, you know, it seems there's always a lot of competition for great ideas out there. But if people haven't seen The Cove is about, you know, the hunting of dolphins in Japan for food. And that film had a tremendous amount of effect on, you know, the amount of, you know, the animals are being killed in Japan right now for meat. It's reduced by 93% since we did that film. But I'm interested in, like, animal intelligence. Like, what are, you know, there's all these AI groups out there that are trying to decipher animal language, and they're getting pretty close, you know. So we're working on a film right now that's it's using, you know, AI to try to figure out animal communication, and that's
Yes,
exciting.
amazing. There's so much to learn from what we don't know with whales and dolphins and.
Okay, well, think about this. I mean, also, okay, whales, you know, those are, you know, big brain animals. What about a butterfly? You know, the monarch butterfly takes three generations to fly from Canada to Mexico. And in Mexico, they're finding this 6-hectare area where they all congregate. Three generations to get down there.
That's amazing. That's I didn't know about that.
That's a hell of a GPS to communicate through your biology. How's that being done? I know it might not be intelligence, but there's something else going on there.
Right.
And I'm fascinated by this idea that we disregard every animal because of our own criteria of what we think of as intelligence. If you say that intelligence is the ability for a species to live within its own ecological boundaries, you would probably say humans are failing. You know, so on that as an intelligence scale, you might say we have pretty poor marks, but everything else looks pretty damn good. Because no other wild animal will go to the, you know, live to the point where they, you know, desecrate their environment, but we're doing that. So is that intelligent? You know, you have, you know, like you bring up whales and dolphins, you know, there's incredible things that we know that they're communicating, you know, where to find food, you know, there's stuff going on, but we think, oh, those are just noises, creaks, squeaks, and codas, but there's probably some really sophisticated communication going on, but we don't know quite what's going on. I'll just tell you a real quick story. There's a guy, when we were doing the Cove, there's this guy, Lou Herman, that was doing a study with captive dolphins. They captured some dolphins off the coast of Hawaii. And dolphins, you can very quickly train to do, let's say, do a flip. And they have these hand signals, and the dolphins get that very readily because, you know, when you're watching a dolphin do a trick, you're not watching like entertainment. You're watching a spectacle of dominance, right? They need to be fed. They learn very quickly. And they also, when you put two dolphins in a tank and you say together, do a flip, they do that quite easily. They put a hydrophone in a tank, and they were recording these two dolphins while they were giving tricks. And one of the researchers had come up with a gesture saying, be creative. So the dolphins, to get fed again, had to come up with a trick on their own to in order to be fed. And the dolphins readily would do that. And then somebody had the brilliant idea, together, be creative. And the first time they did that, my memory was the dolphins did something they'd never done before. They went down into the tank. They came up. They did a 1.5 flip. And they simultaneously spit water into the face of the trainer.
No way. So how do they, that's a, wow.
My point is, in that amount of time, there's a lot of communication going on. So those squeaks, somewhere in there is, go down, do a flip, we're going to spit water in his face. Yeah. But there was something going on there that was communication. And that was kind of the Rosetta Stone. But my memory of the story was that a couple of the grad students that were working on that realized that these animals a lot smarter than we thought, that, and they released them within a couple of days. They went in the middle of the night and brought them out to sea. But anyway, there's a lot more going on with probably all animals, from insects up to blue whales. You know, we did the film called Racing Extinction, and Chris Clark, who was one of the subjects of that film, he said, you know, everything with a heartbeat has a song, from insects up to blue whales. And we don't, he said, we've just stopped listening.
Yeah.
So I think that's the key, is that if we can listen again to these other creatures that we surround this incredible planet with, we're, you know, we'll be a lot better off. And so that's the film I want to make, is like, use AI to sort of as a portal into respecting, you know, the animals that we share the planet with.
Yeah. That's incredible. It'd be great to see that once you've put that together. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and congratulations again.
Thank you so much again. We had a great group of people, and great talking to you again. Cheers.
Yep. See you. Bye. Take care.